You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 28th of April, 2012, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London, with me, Tyler Brulé, and Sophie Grove.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll find out what's been flying off the shelves in the bookshops of Jerusalem, Cape Town and Phnom Penh.
Our bestseller, really, in all our shops is First They Killed My Father by Luang Ung, which is really her experience of living through the Khmer Rouge period and her eventual escape from Cambodia.
And we'll also be chatting to Christian Nyholm, label manager of Fake Diamond Records in Copenhagen, for some Nordic music recommendations.
And we're working through the pages of our stack of magazines with Simon Esterson, art director of I Magazine.
All that and much more right here in The Review, live from London on Monocle 24. And good afternoon from a very damp and dank and rainy London on a Saturday. We're live in Midori House, and it's me, Tyler Brulé, at one mic, and Sophie Grove at the other. Good morning or good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It is indeed a little bit. It's quite cosy in here, actually.
It is very cosy in here. It's always that sort of that parallel universe of being in a studio. But I woke up this morning thinking, where would I rather live in Europe today? And I was able to look at Sweden, and it's sunny in Stockholm, at least it was this morning. And I went to look at Milan and Lugano, and it was like 28 and like big bright sunshine. And
I accidentally had today. I was looking at Marseille weather on my iPhone, and actually I thought it was London. It's so sunny and beautiful. And then I flipped over and thought, oh no. It's not. It's a drought. We have a drought in London, but it's been raining for 2 weeks.
No, it's shocking. I think it's also the teas that we've been having in London of literally 95 seasons, like within the span of 1 hour, sunny, and then it's just been like, and then kind of just horrendous storms. Our poor Fernando, one of our colleagues, he had to fly to Bilbao this week, and it was quite funny because he flew into Bilbao on the day that then all of these videos went up on, started, I think, on the Alpais website. It was all over YouTube of just the most horrendous landings at Bilbao Airport.
I saw them. They looked, I mean, if that was me, I think I would be absolutely freaking out.
I just wouldn't, off the strip. Yeah, I wouldn't even put my aircraft in the air. I just thought, it's not fair to passengers, but I mean, also from a safety point of view, I just thought, are you sort of really sort of trying to squeeze your margins that much by, you know, is it really necessary to fly today?
Poor Fernando from Brazil.
I know.
He really does. Sometimes when the sun comes out, he comes in his wonderful shorts and Brazilian like colours, and you think, I think you're a bit optimistic.
Yeah, you think the sun's
not quite there.
The sun's going to be out by 1500, but it's not. And on the topic of just looking at the morning papers in Europe and staying in Bilbao for a moment, extraordinary to look at Spain's jobless numbers, which came out. I mean, over 50% of Spanish youth of working age. I think it's, we're looking at something around like 51%. Are jobless, which is just incredible.
And staggering.
And a quarter, 24.4% of the total workforce unemployed. So that's what the Financial Times is leading with this morning. Smaller story as well, which has been making news over the last 24 hours. Samsung knocks Nokia off top slot. Nokia has lost its crown as the world's largest mobile phone maker by shipments to Samsung after 14 years of global dominance. And it just really sort of reversal of fortunes. Of course, Nokia's shares or a stock also being downgraded to junk status as well. Not great.
The International Herald Tribune and the Globe edition of the New York Times has got a lovely picture of the Enterprise, the prototype for the space shuttle program, which was ferried by a 747 to Kennedy International Airport on Friday. It's a lovely picture of this shuttle sort of clinging to the 747, sort of like a mothership, and kind of snuggling up to it in a way.
And that's a bit of an end of an era story, isn't it?
It is. And it's going to be displayed at the Intrepid Sea and Airspace Museum in New York. So it's heading for museum and sort of it's going to be in the sort of annals of this amazing NASA program that's no longer.
Just on page 12 of The Independent, this is something which has been receiving a lot of press in this country this week. And we were slightly riveted to the TVs yesterday in our office because Sky News, we're trying to reenact the story of and the death of the British spy or at least MI6 worker Gareth Williams. And for those not familiar with the story, Mr. Williams was found zipped up in a North Face bag in 2010. Inquest has now opened up into the death of this. And so on page 12, I think we all know this, but a headline, almost a full page devoted to the story, spy could not have locked himself in bag. Inquest, all experts tried 400 times, but could not recreate events without help of a third party.
Wow. And they have actually got exactly the same North Face red hold-all.
I wonder what that's done for the fortunes of North Face sales.
I know, I was thinking that too.
Up or down?
Down. I've got a bag a bit like that, and I don't really like it anymore.
I've seen you sort of here trekking off out of the office.
It's exactly the same, and I have to say, it fills me with a bit of horror now I see it.
Absolutely.
It's not red.
No, exactly. I'm actually surprised there's not more stories. I mean, there was something on some of the other websites though about just the horrendous queues at Heathrow Airport. I mean, what a catastrophe! 3 months away from the Olympics, but this week, stories of 4 and 5 hour delays. At Terminal 5, and it's interesting that it's isolated to one terminal at Heathrow Airport. But just a shocking display, and yet sort of another sort of cack-handed move, and not a great week for British politics or general management.
It's such a shame because, I mean, we are about to host one of the biggest events, this decade. And then, Hugo MacDonald, our design editor, was in a queue coming back from Stockholm.
Exactly.
For 3 hours. He said it was just like something out of, some sort of, mass migration, sort of tussling people, elderly people standing up for 3 hours, people with children standing up for 3 hours. You can't have that in a city like London.
No.
I mean, it just says all the wrong things. And I'm just praying that they're going to sort it out of sort of mild patriotism.
I know, and at a time as well when you think that, the rest of Europe, everyone signed up to Schengen, that was great. I was traveling around last week and you sort of just zip, between countries. And also, of course, if they could just get border control, sorted out, on the other side as well. And yeah, and just, and make sure that, they're doing the right things for non-EU passport holders, but they cannot seem to sort it out. And of course, and there's plenty of desks, unmanned. The automated systems don't work.
It's funny because the UK border agency has been under scrutiny so many times. They sort of oscillate between being unbelievably lax and just herding people through, or quite the opposite, sort of painstakingly detailed and difficult, and then creating this mayhem we've seen.
Absolutely. We have a lot ahead on the programme. Of course, we have our magazine review at the very end of the programme, and we're going to be off to Copenhagen to talk music. But up next, right after this, it's our tour of bookshops around the world.
We start today with a regular visit to some of the world's best independent bookshops to find out what titles have been selling well in that part of the globe.
And first up, we head to Israel, to the Educational Bookshop, which has been open for almost 30 years in the heart of Jerusalem.
My name is Imad Muna. The Educational Bookstore today, there's two branches, the old one and the new one. The old one is started in 1986, here where we are now. We start with the Arabic books and with the stationery stuff. And immediately after 2 years, after the beginning of the first Intifada, we start to bring English books, because in that time it was a lot of journalists, diplomatic missions, foreigners came to the city in the beginning of Intifada to search to see what's going on. And it was no materials to them. It was no English bookstores in Jerusalem. And we saw that there's big demand on that. So we start bringing English books, what people ask for, about the Arab-Israeli conflict. In 2009, we opened the new branch, which is across the street of the old one. And since 86 until 2009, we bring more and more English books. So we have a big stock of English books, and most of the books are about the Arab-Israeli conflict and in different languages, mainly in English, but we have in French, in German, and Italian. And we're trying our best to bring comprehensive books, books that are neutral, it's not pro-Palestinian or pro-Israelians, whatever it's written by Palestinians, Arabs, Jewish, or other nationalities. Right now, the best-selling books is the Book of Stephen, which is called Walking Palestine, and this came out just like 2 or 3 months, and it's one of the best books that we're selling right now. But in general, we have some books that all the time we sold them, like the books of Walid Khaldi or Rashid Khaldi, his brother, and also the books of Edward Said. We still sell them since all the time, The Question of Palestine and other. We sell the books of Amir Haas, Tom Saghib, the Arab literature which is translated to English, like Mahmoud Darwish, Hassan Kanafani, other Arabs who translate their works to English. We're planning to expand, but in the same city. Our bookstore, in the beginning, we thought that it's big. It's 120 meters square, 3 floors, the balcony, the main store, and the basement, which is also we do book launches and screening films and so on. But after a while, we find that it's not so big. So our hope in the future that we find bigger place or take next to it another shop and to open them and to expand.
And that was Iman Muna from the Educational Bookshop.
Next up, we are heading way south to South Africa, where we visit the Book Lounge, which is located in the eastern precinct of Cape Town.
My name is Mervin. I'm the owner and founder of the Book Lounge. We just celebrated our 4th birthday in sort of centre of Cape Town, just down the road from Parliament, corner of Roland and Badenkant Streets. I suppose we fall into the category of a general bookshop. I hate that phrase, but that's what people sort of refer to. Obviously, there are types of books that we're stronger on, politics and South African non-fiction. Poetry is another one, short stories. Good fiction is something that we do very, very well with and something that we're passionate about. And then we've got a very big kids section, and we do story time for kids every Saturday morning at 11. And then there's all the stuff which is sort of related to the literary festival that we started last year, which is called the Open Book. And one of the sort of projects that we worked on there was with a school called Matthew Ganiwe Memorial High School in Khayelitsha, which together with Equal Education, we put in a fully stocked library for them. They didn't have a library there, which sounds absolutely shocking, but unfortunately is a very common scenario at the moment in South African schools. This evening we've got our third launch of the week, Owen Sol, who is a fantastic poet and academic at the University of Cape Town, is launching his 6th collection of poetry here with us this evening. It's called Absent Tongues. A lot of the time we will have the author of the book in question in discussion with somebody about their book. Sometimes it's a little bit more than that in the sense that we'll have a sort of panel discussion, and then with something like tonight where it's poetry, there's somebody, Rustam Kazane, who's also a very, very good poet, will be speaking a little bit about it, and then Kelwin will be reading. Bestsellers, tricky, I think, over the last while. Frank Ciccani's memoir, 8 Days in September, has done extremely well. Frank Ciccani was General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches. He was an ANC activist and leader of the struggle and post-democracy. He worked in the presidency under the Mbeki cabinet. And he's just released this book, as I said, called 8 Days in September, which basically describes from the inside everything that went on. Some people call it a coup, with the removal of what was then President Mbeki and his replacement with Jacob Zuma. We recently launched Imran Kavadia's latest novel called Institute for Taxi Poetry, which, as with all his books, is a fantastic novel. We're doing extremely well with that as well. Fiction, we're doing well with Capital, John Lanchester's novel of London, which came out a couple of weeks ago. And yeah, coming up, we've got some very good titles which we're going to be launching. Michiel Haynes has got a new book, Arcs, and his last one, Lost Ground, which came out a year ago, was absolutely superb. So I'm really looking forward to that. Also going to be picking up new Sarah Weaver's memoir. She's one of the authors who's going to be joining us for the festival in September for Open Book. So I'm really looking forward to that as well.
And that was Mervin Sloman, owner of the Book Lounge in Cape Town.
And now we head to Cambodia, where our reporter Guy Delaney paid a visit to the Phnom Penh branch of Monument Books.
My name is William Bagley. I've been in Cambodia now for 4 years, and I'm the group purchasing manager for Monument Books. Monument Books is the only international bookshop in Cambodia, and we also have divisions, branches in Laos and Myanmar now. We try to make this as world class as possible. We thought that it should look a bit more like a library, so we have got wooden shelves displays. We don't have MDF units. We have built specially designed shelves to make this look a high quality area to walk into. We've also added the toy format as well, and this was a determined way to try to also attract more Cambodians into the store. And we thought that there was a natural fit between books and toys in terms of selling to families. This cafe sits in between the book and toys floor, and actually I'm afraid it's a very effective honey trap, and it's been a roaring success. We do sell quite a lot of books that have Asian themes or development themes in the fiction area, but also, of course, there are many people interested in development topics. So we have a section here on poverty and the eradication of poverty and how to improve water systems. We are cautious buyers because we buy the books. They come here. We can't return them as you can when you are a bookseller in the UK or the US. So we buy them up front and we have to sell them. So we do the best that we can. Our best seller really in all our shops is First They Killed My Father by Luong Ung, which is really her experience of living through the Khmer Rouge period and her eventual escape from Cambodia. And then The Gate by Francois Bizot, which is his story of having met the butcher of Camp S21. He has just been tried and found guilty, and so this book is selling fast again. But on the fiction side, we've done well with A Visit from the Goon Squad, which was the book that won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2011 by Jennifer Egan. And then my personal favourite, which didn't sell as well, but has a gorgeous cover, called The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, which is set in Japan, is written by David Mitchell. He gives hope to booksellers everywhere. He started off as a bookseller at Waterstones in England. But one of our perennial bestsellers, both here and in Laos, in fact, of course, are the books by Colin Cotterill, the British humorist who writes a series of books based on a 75-year-old pathologist who has been ordered out of retirement by the Communist Party in Laos. There are now 6 or 7 novels from this. They're very, very funny. He's a very characterful writer. Colin Cotterill is really very, very popular amongst people here, and he does very, very well.
And that was William Bagley, Group Purchasing Manager at Monument Books in Phnom Penh.
And we should probably qualify that they're not quite independent. It's, you know, we did the story because it's slightly obscure, but they have 12 stores in 6 cities throughout Cambodia, plus they're in Laos, as he was mentioning, and also in Myanmar as well. So actually, 4 stores in Cambodia, 6 in total. So not so small, but it sounds like a bit of a regional sort of Barnes & Noble.
It does. And I love the Cape Town store. It sounds so cosy.
Yeah.
And like the sort of epicentre of all things intellectual and poetic happening in Cape Town.
I think you and I both decided if there wasn't a June issue to get out the door upstairs, which we have to return to in 39 minutes, that we would be heading off to Daunt to certainly sort of stock up. Because also there's some great, we'll be chatting about the New Yorker a little bit later. There's some great stuff in there. Anyway, stay with us because coming up after the break, we'll be indulging in some Nordic music with Christian Nyholm of Fake Diamond Records. Stay with us.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
On the latest edition of The Menu with me, Markus Hippi, we grab our library card and visit Chicago to get a lesson in growing your own food. We also head to Istanbul in search of the best Turkish coffee, and we find out about the art of fine dining. That's a plethora of foodie stories for you.
He said that it's the most beautiful, delicious, sweet tomato that he's ever grown.
Of course, we will find out what's in Santiago's basket. We'll get a great dinner soundtrack recommendation, and as always, much, much more on the latest episode of The Menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove, and Tyler Boulay.
And it's now time for our weekly music review. And today we're crossing to Denmark to welcome Christian Nyholm, label manager at Fake Diamond Records, who joins us on the line now. Hello, Christian.
Hello.
How are you? Good. I hope the weather is better in Copenhagen than it is in London today.
It's not. It's very London-ish here as well. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's very Copenhagen-ish here then. Well, hopefully you can put a spring in the step of those who are listening in sort of inclement conditions. State of the nation music-wise in Denmark at the moment. I mean, of course, we're punching well above your weight at the moment when it comes to TV series. It must be a great time to be a television producer, because if you can put out another crime series, then people all over the world are going to lap it up.
Yeah, it's the whole culture thing here in Denmark is going really well. I mean, the whole film scene and the TV scene and the music scene as well. Yeah, we're going through great changes here, which is very, you know, inspired to be part of.
And Christian, what do you think, who are these new bands that are coming through? I mean, we've seen this kind of amazing legacy of Danish music. What do you think the next generation is sounding like?
We have like the whole, in Denmark at the moment, like internally, there's kind of like a rising, like actually a hip-hop, dancehall, reggae scene at the moment happening, which is about to come right quite successful here. But in a more international scale, I think like the whole like shoegaze kind of thing, like the more melancholic, atmospheric, kind of like blue Scandinavian sound is going really well at the moment. And it's kind of like being significant for a Scandinavian sound, and what is really like branding the Scandinavian is working really well in outside territories. So it's interesting.
And Christian, speaking of melancholic, wonderful tracks, let's listen to one of your label's tracks. And your first song is Darkness Falls with Timeline.
Always following, I suppress what I should do. Always run when I'm not supposed to. Always fall when I suppress what I should do. Always run when I'm not supposed to. Always fall when I suppress what I should do.
And that was Darkness Falls with Timeline, and you are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. We're chatting to Christian Nyholm, who is with Fake Diamond Records in Copenhagen. Christian, tell us a little bit about Darkness Falls.
Yeah, Darkness Falls is it's a female duo formed in 2009, and it's consisting of Josephine and Ina, and they have been in many constellations before, but this is like a new constellation, which is I think that will be the one constellation in the future as well, because it's going really well. And the EP and album, which was released this fall, is produced by Trandemøller, Anders Trandemøller, which is a quite big name here as well. They're touring at the moment in Europe and South America, actually. Mm. And this is the second single Timeline we're just listening to.
Great. I want to just to keep the musical tempo up. I want to go listen to Vinnie Who. This is their song Killer Bee, and when we come back, we'll have a little chat about them as well. And that was Vinnie Hu with Killer Bee here on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Review with me, Tyler Berlay, and Sophie Grove. And down the line in Copenhagen, we have Christian Nyholm from Fake Diamond Records. Just to tell us a little bit about Vinnie Hu as well, Christian.
Yeah, Vinnie Hu is a guy I feel very fortunate to manage. And he's a young, promising, one-man army disco guy, and he's he has an EP and album behind him, which was out on EMI, and is now in the studio recording his new album, which will be out this fall. And he's just, I really believe that he's one of the next big comets here from Denmark. He's like one of the most promising names in this generation. So he's a very interesting cat. So that's, and he's amazing live as well. So it's very interesting.
And Christian, I mean, you seem like you have very high hopes for Vinnie. He's been touring all over Europe. But how representative is he of the Copenhagen scene? Is he very much the grassroots sort of disco scene there?
I mean, he's quite one of a kind here, because normally people have a tendency to kind of like be very like behind and the background kind of, and he has this very like, I don't know, maybe international format, so like really in your face, and that's not very Danish. So in that sense, he's one of a kind. So that's interesting.
Now, Christian, you mentioned reggae being the future earlier, but finally, this is a band you're managing, Laid Back, whose new album, Cozy Land, will be out in Europe on the 7th of May and the US on the 22nd of May. This is the title track, Cozy Land.
And that was Laid Back with Cozy Land. Sophie, do you want to live in Cozy Land?
I do. It sounds lovely.
Yeah,
it's enveloped us.
I think the whole sort of notion of Laid Back and Cozy Land sounds like a wonderful place. Just before we go, Christian, I do want to put a bid in. I liked all of them, but I'd have to say that. That Vinnie Hu really ticked the box for me.
Yeah, that got our feet tapping a little
bit.
Yeah,
so if there's any scope that they're coming to London and we could somehow coax them into coming into studio, that would be great.
Yeah, of course. And let's do the my Dory House Station as well. I was there doing this with Gianna Factory, who is actually like the record of the week next week at Monaco, I guess. So let's do it with Vinnie Hu as well.
We love Gianna Factory. That's another one of your finds. They're great girls.
Absolutely. When we're off air, we'll drop you a note, because we've got some plans for some rather big plans in June. Not quite the Roskilde Festival, but maybe one peg down. Christian Nyholm from Fake Diamond Records. Tack for that, and have a great weekend.
Thank you. It was nice talking to you guys.
Thank you. You're listening to The Review. We're in London, and we're live, and we're back right after this.
The latest edition of Section D, we're doing a roundup of all that happened at the 51st Salone del Mobile, the annual Milan Furniture Fair. We've got a fantastic cast of guests from all angles of the industry and corners of the globe. together with a string of reports from the fair and city each day as it unfolded. Plus tons of news, numerous views, and plenty of voices from the fair itself.
I mean, we've done the, you know, young designer stuff, the prototype, the gallery, the handmade, the homemade, the DIY, and now we really want to move to contacting people and making industrial products.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This is the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors turned DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block, music on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Tyler Brulé, and Sophie Grove. And of course, every weekend here at Midori House, we enjoy a good dissection of some of our favourite magazine titles. And to help us to do that today, we're joined by Simon Esterson, Art Director at I Magazine. Welcome.
Good morning.
I mean, normally there's quite a big stack of titles, and I'm talking when we really sort of from a vertical perspective, but you've got quite a few titles today. But we're in slightly sort of thin weekly territory. I see we've got a copy of The New Yorker open over there, and then also Business Week. So why are we going to start on those?
Well, I thought we should start by talking about some weeklies. Mm. And I think in a way The New Yorker and Bloomberg Business Week are exemplars of extreme ends of how to use design in making a magazine. Mm. I mean, I think they're both terrific pieces of journalism. But on one side, you've got The New Yorker, where it's intensely traditional, looks like the way it's always looked, authoritative. But everything it does fantastically. The writing goes without saying, but the photography and, of course, the drawings. And, you know, I would buy it just to see a Roz Chast cartoon or a Christoph Niemann drawing in the financial section. Everything else is a bonus, I think. It's amazing that a magazine that looks old, in fact, for me, has some of the most contemporary journalism you can read. I mean, it's real, proper reporting.
Absolutely. And there was, I'm just trying to find the wonderful little comic spot as well, which just seems so on point. And just where something like The New Yorker can just be so timely, even, you know, even in the age when sort of, you know, people can get all kinds of illustration up on their websites. And this was a piece which comes off the back, of course, of the big scandal in Cartagena with the recent conference there. And you have an image of this, you know, long wheelbase, the presidential vehicle. And you have one of potentially naughty Secret Servicemen standing out in front. And it says, the caption is, "I told you never to call me at this number."
Yeah.
And it's just that, I mean, that to me, from a timeliness point of view, political comment, everything, is just the best of The New Yorker.
Absolutely. And you feel as though you're sitting in a coffee shop in New York.
Yeah.
Even if you're not.
Absolutely. So then on the other side, because it's quite a striking cover that Bloomberg Business Week has, you know, this week. And I just, I mean, you know, as an art director, just give us your sort of spin on what they've got this week.
This week's cover is a menacing man with a chainsaw. And the cover line all over the picture is "My Life in Private Equity." And it's a story about a journalist joining one of these private equity companies and going to the kind of boot camp where they learn how to make business more efficient. In a way, Bloomberg's covers are its, well, they've rescued the whole magazine. It's, you know, it was Business Week. It's now Bloomberg Business Week. Brilliant new editor, ex-New York Times, Time magazine. Mm. Brilliant English art director, Richard Turley. And they've taken what was a rather staid business magazine and turned it completely upside down. And it begins with the covers. The covers are increasingly kind of dramatic and outrageous and, as a result, award-winning.
Mm.
And inside, it's the opposite of The New Yorker. It's really good journalism, but it's, a kind of sugar rush of design, graphics everywhere, highlighted copy, things kind of taped to the page. I mean, it's a bunch of people who could do polite design, but have kind of decided that maybe it's more fun to go beyond that a bit.
Mm.
It's wonderful how they take such a dry topic of corporate efficiency experts and just manage to really sort of unpack that and make it into this kind of wonderfully sort of salacious story. Especially the cover, it's so arresting. You just want to just get in there and start sort of reading about something that you possibly never touched if it wasn't handled like this.
Absolutely. And then inside, you know, that great Chinese case of people called Boo and people called Goo, made into a fantastic double page kind of information graphic, which it both has fun, but actually I'm understanding it in a way I didn't perhaps understand it before. And then you turn over to a piece about a small newspaper in Mexico that's actually daring to write about the drug wars. So it's, I mean, I suppose it's a symbol of the way that business is now news. You know, it's not just a little journalistic ghetto anymore. It's the story, or at least Bloomberg behaves as though it's the story.
Do you think it's slightly curious because, you know, for, you know, a very powerful brand like Bloomberg, which has just vaulted to become this, you know, extraordinary media organization, not just breaking business news. I mean, they're a proper news organization through and through, and they've got, you know, television. You know, they've got a television channel, you know, beaming out around the world. Of course, they've got the power of their terminals and a very profitable business for them. But it's curious, don't you think, that it was actually a piece of print that, you know, Bloomberg, maybe not Michael Bloomberg directly, but Bloomberg goes and buys, you know, Business Week. And from McGraw-Hill, I guess, who published it before, they completely transform it. And I think it's interesting how a small piece of print actually has almost been the wind in the sails of the Bloomberg brand.
Absolutely. But I guess if you're outside the world of business, you didn't sit at your Bloomberg terminal. The amazing thing, of course, is that so behind this magazine are those incredible resources. You know, if you want a chart done, well, there's 150 people who'll give you all the data from all over the world instantaneously. And those are resources that most conventional publishers just can't mobilise.
You really feel like, I mean, with both these publications, there's so much resource. They're setting the agenda. And it's interesting that you mentioned that, you know, business has become the news and the way that New Yorker is looking at these news stories is so typical of the kind of New Yorker mentality. They're telling stories about the Bochelice scandal. You know, they're really crafting a narrative out of that story rather than the slightly sort of staccato coverage that we've seen of it all over the world press. And they're looking at radicals in a letter from Alexandria by Wendell Stevenson, which is amazing. It's all of these news stories just kind of told in this wonderfully sort of artful way.
I think it's actually about reporting, you know, not just responding to a little news story, but actually going and finding a story. There's a story here in the New Yorker about the sort of food police in America, in California, arresting people who were selling unprocessed, unpasteurized milk and cheese, organic cheese, in their food market. And they're rather romantically known as the Rawsome Three, who have all been arrested. And it's just a fantastic story. But being the New Yorker, it kind of goes on for several pages because, you know, somebody's been really working at it as opposed to just, you know, retweeting it or something.
Absolutely. And I think this is, you know, it's still one of the most wonderful things about this is that, you know, even if you have a one-week tour around Asia, you can still have a very light bag because all you need is the New Yorker. And, you know, for very long, like, you know, because you will doze off through a couple of them after a couple of glasses of wine. And that's the great thing about it. And you can just come back and revisit it.
It does have an iPad app. And I've tried the iPad app. But the iPad app, you can't scrunkle up and put in your bag.
So. No.
The print version still does it for me.
I also like, you know, there's this fascinating ad.
I saw that.
Did you see? And this ad, I mean, and here's a great plug for Swan Galleries, yeah, in New York. So there's going to be, they have an image, just a wonderful image of a Paul Rand IBM piece, and it's hand signed, it's inscribed. So they're having an auction coming up, and I'm marking this page because I definitely.
It's not very expensive, is it? It's $4,000 or something.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so that's, yes, I mean, you know, maybe we're going to be bidding against each other, Simon, this, but I thought, and that's, I just also like sort of the quirkiness and the surprise as well, where you have small, you know, whether it's a small gallery, and I also like all these retirement villages when you see these tiny ads where you can go and like live up in the hills in North Carolina amongst sort of fluffy cows, sort of like cozy land. Yeah, very cozy land.
Or you can have a quiet drug rehabilitation program. I mean, there's another kind of analysis, isn't there, which is what you can tell about a magazine from its advertising.
Absolutely.
Which is probably another program.
That's a series. If you want. Well, what else do you have?
Do you want to talk about Stern?
Yeah, I've been fascinated by watching, you know, Stern, and we're huge fans here of news weeklies in general. I think it's such a great time for news weeklies, and It's really interesting when you mentioned the iPad app of how the German media companies have been just, they're very skeptical and they're very German and they take their time. And I think we've covered Der Spiegel a lot, how they have just a great business model. And Stern, of course, is a very iconic magazine, famous for having many years ago, just wonderful photo editors. They don't have quite the same photojournalism certainly they used to have. But I just wonder what your view on that is as well, because the German Newsweekly is a very peculiar animal almost globally compared to the US Newsweeklies or what you see from neighboring France or down the road in Italy.
Well, I have a slight problem because my German, it really isn't very good. Frankly, it's non-existent.
Just look at it as an art director. Everyone says that art directors never read. That's what we always hear,
I know,
right?
And that's a terrible, terrible thing to say about art directors. And I know but the wonderful history of Stern, the famous picture of the desk that's so long there's mist at the end, of all the editors talking about whatever they're going to put in it. I look at this magazine now and I don't know who it's for. Mm. It has no character. It has no personality. It's repetitious and it's intensely bland. Every picture is pretty much exactly the sort of boring picture you might pick off a really good stock library website. There's kind of, I guess this is what's left of their picture coverage, a couple of kind of spreads at the front. Well, that's nice. The Guardian reinvented the double page news picture and proved that you can make it work in a daily paper. But that's, the rest of the magazine is so tedious. The only bit I actually liked that I got to, I discovered were some fashion pictures taken in 1963 at the pyramids. And actually, at the pyramids or on location in a Hamburg shipyard. And they look really good. They're the best thing in the magazine. It's a bit embarrassing.
And that was from the golden, probably one would exactly. say the golden era of the magazine.
Exactly. I think what they need to do is to rediscover that golden age in whatever form that can be done now. But I was worried when your producers showed me this and said, you want to talk about the redesign. I was worried this was
redesign. No, and that's, I think there's a big question. There's a lot of people are saying, where does this magazine go right now? And I think, many of, certainly sort of, the firm of good German journalism and also art directors, people want to go back to this golden age at a time. And I remember, a former colleague who used to work there said, even as recently as sort of the late 80s, the culture editor had it written into his contract. He was allowed to then go and spend, he had a house in Tuscany, and he also happened to be a pianist as well. And he loved his one pianist as part of his contract. He would be able to work from Tuscany for 3 months during the summer, but also the magazine would have to pay to move his piano down as well. I mean, could you imagine doing that at a British newspaper today, saying...
No, not at all. But none of that eccentricity genius comes out. It's all been ironed out at some point. And I think that's the problem, really, that there is... I didn't see a personality or get anything off the pages, really. Mm.
I've heard that Michael Kimmerman from the IHT has his piano shipped wherever he likes to go.
Really?
Yeah, he's also a pianist.
Well, see, I think we're all for that level of eccentricity, sort of, existing on editorial floors. What else do? Should we move on from weeklies?
Yeah, sure. This time last week, I was at the Facing Pages magazine conference in Arnhem, which is a little conference of independent magazine publishers and editors and designers and things. And the energy coming off people making magazines themselves, not conventional publishing, their kind of passion and the variety of things was just amazing. I mean, much more interesting than any PPA conference I've ever been to, And I picked up a few things while I was there. There's a couple of things I didn't bring. The most amazing thing I saw was an Australian motorbike magazine called Head Full of Snakes, which is printed on a kind of office type risograph duplicator, which somehow the aesthetic of it being a bit fuzzy and not perfect perfectly fits these oily 1960s motorbikes. And then at the back they had a flexi disc bound in, and the flexi disc was basically the noise of a 1952 Black Shadow. I probably got that wrong. Mm. Black Shadow motorbike, which just sounds great to me.
And was that is that sort of a limb? I mean, is it done? From an execution point of view, it's very sort of raw and gritty. But also, is it $50 for a copy? Or
no, it's quite cheap. But there were only 500 copies, and I'm desperately searching for a copy of myself right now. But and then other things, slightly more conventional, perhaps. This is a magazine called Offscreen. First, it comes from Australia. This is the first issue done by somebody called Kai Brack. And Kai Brack is an internet designer. They've decided that it's time to do something in print. At one point in the little introduction, they say, putting these stories on real paper, they would exist beyond next week. They might be read for 5 years or even 25 years, when few remember this iPhone app or that blog post. It's material evidence of an intangible world. So it's a wonderful example of somebody doing digital design, making a printed magazine about digital design. And it's really well done. It's really enjoyable.
I love that pointed statement. It's almost a manifesto of somebody that's converted and had enough of frittering in the ether.
Or realise the virtues of permanence and print.
I'm not sure what your view is, but it strikes us that there's a lot of really good stuff coming out of Australia at the moment. And I'm wondering if that's also because, you know, Australia continues to endure as probably, you know, the one English language market that really believes in print. And I mean, we can see it from our own magazine that it's just, you know, no matter what, you know, the Aussie economy is doing very well, but maybe it's always because of that traditional remoteness. There is just that love of magazines, and now I think you've got a generation almost who've grown up with, you know, they saw sort of the surge of zines, and then I think, you know, and probably that generation who've also just caught the tail end of great stuff coming out of London that was sort of landing on newsstands in Australia, and now there's just Adelaide, Brisbane, you know, all kinds of good stuff.
Amazing things. But although at Facing Pages, it wasn't just Australia; it was, you know, Germany and England. My personal little favourite is always, you know, Fire and Knives, the Tim Hayward's food magazine. And I really enjoy that as a magazine that, you know, uses the internet to sell copies and sell subscriptions. You can't really buy it in many bookshops.
No, but yet you wish that there were more, because I actually discovered that. It's just strange. I discovered that at Papercut in Stockholm. And yet you'd really sort of struggle in London or any other city of scale in this country actually to find a copy of it on the newsstand.
I haven't seen a copy. I think you struggle to find good newsstands. I mean, when you do find, they're really good. So I was in Wardour News this morning desperately trying to find somebody with Bloomberg Business Week, and that, you know, there was a fantastic collection of magazines on show.
Yeah, but it's few and far between. Oddly, we talking about being at a conference, you know, we were saying that doesn't there need to be the paper companies, the distributors, the printers? I mean, actually, one of our printers went bankrupt this week.
Oh, really?
In this country. I'm not sure. One of our cover printers, anyway. Yeah. And so, you know, you see also just, you know, the range of papers, you know, the almost titles are, you know, are forced into using almost. It's a tricky time. But coming back from the conference, is there a spring in your step, wind in your sails? Or
Absolutely. Absolutely. Lots of interesting magazines to make and talk about.
And what we've got, just a little bit more time, is anything, I can't see, is anything else on the other side of the screen?
There's a redesigned Frieze magazine, this month, the May issue of Frieze. I mean, Frieze is an amazing story, isn't it? From going from a small saddle-stitched magazine to the art fairs. I think the New York Art Fair starts later this month, later,
yes,
in May, doesn't it? So I guess this is what the redesign coincides with. And this magazine's got what a publisher I used to work with called Thud Factor. I won't do the thud thing.
Do it. No, that's radio.
This is publishing Thud Factor. Okay, that's about a magazine that comes in at, weighs in at 248 pages, a large chunk of which is advertising, which is great news for, I guess, the publisher and the printer. And it's a very nice redesign, you know, uncoated review section at the back, nice kind of contemporary typography in the main section. But the main overwhelming impression is just of sheer magazine publishing confidence, I think.
Which we love.
I mean, when you see these redesigns, where do you think that they felt that they were going wrong before? I was just looking at an old copy from last month. It feels fresh. Yeah, what do you think they've changed, really?
I think it was time for a change. I thought the previous design of Frieze was good. Frieze is a good magazine. It's not in the Stern category. You know, you sometimes see a magazine and you think, goodness gracious, you know, I'd love to get my hands on that. Or, you know, we also think, well, quite, why has it got into that state? I don't think that was the case with Frieze. I think it was, you know, new teams, time for a kind of change around, and a new art director to inject some of the things they were passionate about.
Great.
Into the design.
Simon Esterson, art director. I thank you very much for that.
Pleasure.
And I think that's all the time we have for this edition of The Review. Today's show was produced by Katie Bilboa and was researched by poor Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who had to be in those dreadful landings in Bilbao, and also our studio manager is Alex Funnell.
You can catch our pick of this week's Best Monocle 24 Stories, Guests and Features on The Curator, which is up next. And don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at 11 a.m. London time, with Robert Bound, Julian De Bias and Andrew Muller.
And we are almost out of time, so we can shuffle off to Daunt, or maybe to Wardour News to pick up a few magazines. But for all of us here in London, it's goodbye from me, Tyler Brulé and Sophie Grove. Have a very good weekend. Goodbye.